Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Has Trump lost Arizona, and has Biden lost the war on inflation? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Dominator, Dominic Pino, Philip Phil Klein, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National U podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices and the University of Austin. More about both of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, Republicans have not been particularly bold or optimistic about the issue of abortion post-Dobbs, but this week felt like an inflection point. We had Trump, which we discussed earlier in the week, saying he's just going to let the state sort this out. And then you had this ruling in Arizona saying that since Roe has been repealed, this 1864 abortion law that's been on the books since 1864 and is a sweeping prohibition with no exceptions, it is the law of Arizona. And Republicans have been scurrying in the other direction, including the Senate candidate Carrie Lake, even though she endorsed this law. It was very easy to endorse such things in theory in the pre-Dobbs environment. What do you make of it?
Yeah, this is a big problem for Republicans in that we know that a law like this is profoundly unpopular. We know that the ballot initiative strategy that pro-choicers have been deploying has been very successful. They've usually been very successful at doing, in a sense, what Roe v. Wade did, which is providing legal abortion in many more circumstances than popular opinion probably would do explicitly, but underneath, a kind of euphemistic slogan or set of rules that people can agree to when they're, truncated and shortened on a little piece of paper in a voting booth. So Republicans need, a real alternative. They need to rally, behind an alternative and argue for an alternative. In Arizona, that might be, something like a 12-week ban with some exceptions, 15-week ban with some exceptions, something like that. And they need to unite it around it as a party and talk about it and why it's preferable to what Democrats are going to put on the statewide ballot.
To be clear, they can't pass this in law. They hold both chambers, but the governor is a Democrat, beat Carrie Lake. And she's not going to sign anything. So this creates a ideal environment for a cynical Democratic maneuver. Oh, this 1864 law is so horrible. Let's leave it on the books, all the way till November, so we can use it as a foil.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if the Republican Party in Arizona did rally and pass it in the legislature and unite around it, first of all, it'd be a good exercise for them in actually uniting around anything in the Arizona GOP. But second, it would put some pressure, right? Because if the 1864 law is so hateful to Arizonans now, and the Republican alternative is clearly preferable to them than that, then it would create some political pressure, and it would also ease the pain for Republicans running for re-election. Right now, they have the worst of all worlds, where they have no clear position. They're afraid to talk about it, and they're running away. So they look like cowards. They look like they have no conviction And they're going to get blamed for inflicting a law that the majority won't support anymore. So, you know, the worst thing they can do is what they're doing now, which is next to nothing.
Yeah. So Phil, obviously the fact that the Arizona GOP is so chaotic is not a good thing at the moment, where you need more coherence to deal with what is basically a political crisis. But a big problem here, you know, Republicans have shown you can have Republican controlled legislatures pass prohibitions, protections is a better way to put it, for unborn life, and have Republicans governors sign them and survive. You know, that we've tested that proposition and it's worked out in several notable states. But the bigger problem, though, and certainly when it comes to any sort of ballot initiative, it doesn't seem to matter where you're putting your gestational limit. What people hear is it's a ban, it's a prohibition. And the other side gets to say, they're against abortion, they're banning it, you know, whether it's 12, 15, 20, whatever. And we really need freedom of choice for healthcare. And that argument, unfortunately, so far, just seems to be a total Trump card.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Charlie has made this point well, comparing it to the inverse issue of gun control, in that the Democrats will point toward some sort of quote-unquote reasonable measure, like increased background checks or whatever it is, or we're going to ban this narrow point of gun. And then But then Republicans will say, look, Democrats just want to ban guns. And because of that, there is no gun control is completely dead. Yeah.
And then also, Phil, we're able to use, you know, they favor like extending the waiting period, right? Most Democratic politicians, or whatever it is, some incremental step. And then the New York Times has a big editorial. Well, we need to ban and confiscate. And then we can say, well, see, that's what they're really after, right? And that argument works.
And it works for us too, because ultimately we know, I mean, our position is, I mean, the incrementalist position on the pro-life laws is essentially, we'll take the best that we can get now with the hopes of winning over hearts and minds and getting something better down the road. But I think that the issue, I think the thing that really is worrisome to me, if you look at the bigger picture, listen to, you know, some of the rhetoric that Carrie Lake is using in the statement she put out, where she said that, you know, I'm the only woman in the race, and this is a personal issue between the people and their states, which is sort of a way to try to frame the Federalist argument for abortion being a state issue, as in the sort of pro-choice rhetoric, which I think is sort of nowhere in that is she talking about we have to balance the public opinion with the imperative to protect life. Like, there was no pro-life argument in any of her statement at all, that it actually is important to protect life. And my fear is that we're on the path where essentially the abortion issue and the pro-life cause for Republicans becomes like Obamacare or the gay marriage issue, where they just don't want to touch it. And at some point, Democrats get a large enough control in Congress that they just pass some sort of, you know, if it's not fully codifying pro, it'll be just something awful at the national level. And Republicans won't really, you know, they may talk about it, but when push comes to shove and they get in there, I mean, Trump is down after talking about repeal as recently as 6 months ago on Obamacare. He's now saying today, like, I'm not going to get rid of the ACA, I just want to make it better. So I feel like, you know, we may be 5-10 years away from a situation in which Republicans might say that abortion's bad, but they're not going to go in there and actually try to do anything about it.
So Dominic, that is the worst case, that Republicans, right, most of them probably, if you ask them, would say they're against gay marriage, but they never talk about it. And the first step was they kind of lost the ability to make the public argument for it. not for opposing gay marriage. And that's a hard argument. It's much harder than the argument, I think, on abortion. But if Carrie Lake is at all kind of an indicator, and Trump's kind of an indicator here too, they don't want to argue about it. They don't want to make the case. And maybe the party just kind of loses the ability and the will to make the case. So it becomes, in some theoretical case, in some theoretical sense, a pro-life party, but functionally isn't. You know, it's the same way. It's in favor maybe of reforming Social Security. We just never hear about it, and they're obviously never going to do it.
Well, I think first of all, we should take a step back and appreciate how completely hilarious it is for the person giving lectures on public opinion and winning elections being Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake has proven that she is not good at these things. She holds views well outside the mainstream of the of the general electorate, mainly that, you know, the 2020 election was in some way stolen. That is a huge thing that will drag her down.
There's also the irony, right? Here's this like enormously consequential moral issue, abortion. Like, no, let's not fight on that. But let's fight about the 2020 election. That we can never give up our position on that.
Exactly. So I think the idea that we need to pay much attention to what she's saying about winning elections, I think, is silly. And what you said before as well, Rich, you know, you know, Republicans have proven that they can act and take meaningful pro-life measures and still win. It's not just that they've proven that they can do that. In 2022, every single pro-life governor who ran for re-election won re-election. That includes Brian Kemp in Georgia, Ron DeSantis in Florida. A lot of these guys won really big, with Kemp running against Stacey Abrams, of course, every Democrat's favorite losing gubernatorial candidate. So I think the panic among a lot of Republicans on this is overstated, because if you can actually act on this in the ways that they have in some of these other states, you know, passing heartbeat bills, which are fantastic pro-life measures, and then not only winning, but winning by a larger margin than you won your first election, I think that's a positive sign for Republicans.
So MBD, is anything over the last couple of days soften your view of what Trump's done here politically? You know, Republicans aren't going to get any sort of federal prohibition. If you say you're in favor of federal prohibition, it would be used against you, you know, in a huge way. So maybe it's best to let prudence rule and just go to a position that, you know, not what we want in principle, or necessarily some of us are in favor in principle, like Charlie, but not what we'd ideally want, but maybe is the best thing to try to stanch the bleeding looking ahead till November.
On the one hand, I would say no, because Trump has consistently worsened this by denigrating state laws, right? Like, as they exist. So he went from saying he's going to respect whatever the states do to saying like Arizona needs to be fixed and so on.
Yeah, and I think he also say if he got any federal legislation, he wouldn't support it. I mean, it was kind of a veto threat.
So
it's Florida. I mean, he attacked. Yeah. I mean, some of that was obviously primary stuff, but I think that he's made pretty clear that 6-week bans, even if they can pass in states, are too harsh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's just wrong about that, right?
Well, on the other hand, I mean, just pure Republican cowardice over the course of the week and timidity has me wondering if Trump's isn't the best stance. You know, is like, okay, leave this as much to the activists to get after Republicans in states, and just, you know, do not pressure the national party to come up with a coherent stance.
Where do we think the DeSantis would be right now if he were the nominee? Did he ever pronounce? He always was dancing around it where he would be on national legislation.
Where do we think DeSantis would be?
Yeah.
I think he'd probably be with Graham's 15 weeks mm-hmm. and exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
With states being able to reduce that rather than that as like a floor for the entire country.
Mm-hmm. So Phil Klein asks a question to you. If you had to guess right now, you would say Donald Trump has lost Arizona the last couple days, and so has Kerry Lake.
I think Trump loses Arizona, but not necessarily just because of this issue. I mean, I think that, you know, he lost in 2020 and she lost in 2022, and it's the same team that's now in 2024. So I would say that has more to do with it. I don't think this helps, but I don't think this would be the reason.
Dominic.
Yeah, I agree with Phil. Losers lose.
MVD.
All right, make it three.
Three? He's going to lose Arizona. I was somewhat optimistic about Arizona, but now I'm pessimistic. So if I'm forced, as I am, by my own exit question to pronounce, I would say he's going to lose Arizona, which then puts a lot of pressure on those so-called blue wall states. Maybe that doesn't matter that much because they seem to kind of go in unison, or at least they have in 16 and 20, but this makes Arizona much harder. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor. This is a message from Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child? Or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interests at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority. If bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or a homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific, your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com because parents matter. Patriotvoices.com. So, Dominic, not great news in Arizona for Republicans, not great news on the inflation front for President Biden. We're going along at a 3-point-something rate, 3.5, 3.8, whatever it is. But there was a victory lap there in the Bidenomics era of Biden's advocacy for his economic record. We haven't heard that phrase in that word in a while, and maybe won't ever again.
Well, it might still be said, but might be said more by Republicans than by Democrats. I think March's inflation year over year was 3.5%, according to the Consumer Price Index. The real story with inflation, though, goes back to June of 2023. So June of 2022 was the peak of inflation, around 9% year over year. But that declined after that, which is great. But since June of 2023, inflation has been between 3% and 3.8% year over year every single month. So the progress bringing inflation back down stopped in June of 2023, and we're just sort of bouncing around between 3 and 4 right now. The Federal Reserve's long run inflation target is 2%. That's a pretty standard long-run inflation target for central banks around the world. There's nothing magic about the number 2.
That's what I was just going to ask. Is there something magic about the number 2?
No, there's not. But the reason they want it to be a little bit higher than 0 is to give central banks room to stimulate the economy in the event of a recession. That's the reasoning behind it. There's debate over whether that's wise. But the point is that it doesn't matter exactly what number it is. What matters is that the Fed has committed itself to bringing inflation back to 2% in the long run. The Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, has been very, very clear on this ever since inflation got out of control, which again was partially and perhaps mostly the Federal Reserve's fault to begin with. But he's been very clear that he wants to get it back down to 2% in the long run. Now, the difference between 2% and 3 or 4% might not sound like a lot, but it's sort of the evil twin of the fact that 3% GDP growth is way better than 2% GDP growth. Another way to think about it is that, a 4% inflation is twice as high as 2% inflation. So we don't want inflation to be increasing at double the rate it should be. And so we're closer to 4% right now than we are to 2%. And the Fed needs to get it back down because a very important thing that central banks have is credibility on fighting inflation and on having their monetary policy mean what it says. And if we lose that, that gets to a situation where the Federal Reserve becomes even more politicized than it already is. We don't want to be in a world where that's the case.
So MBD, this obviously politically is just a killer. It's one of the main things that's hurting Biden beyond just the general sense of incompetence, which began with the Afghan withdrawal and the age and the border on the economy. It's overwhelmingly inflation because you're not getting real wage growth. I guess we were getting real wage growth for a little while there, but still the maybe we still are now, but the prices, they don't go down just because the inflation rate goes down some, right? It's accruing over time, and it's really felt by people.
Yeah, and it's felt by them literally like all the time. As in like, you know, every grocery trip, every time they order food out, especially, I think is one that's really getting on people, is that, you're literally seeing a decline in your lifestyle when you're, you know, making cuts to luxuries that a few years ago you were accustomed to. It's really gumming up housing as people are terrified with the fact that in any place that's worth, that has like economic opportunity in the United States, housing prices haven't come down, and yet inflation rates have gone way up. And so interest rates on mortgages are way up, making, you know, borrowing money much more expensive and the price of a mortgage much more forbidding. So we have good employment numbers that in most years you would think would serve the incumbent very well. But a lot of that, employment at the very edge is part-time employment, or it's employment of immigrants who recently came in, some of them illegally, although they've been given work permits in a lot of cases, as they await asylum hearings that they'll never show up for. A lot of people just feel that they're working harder and yet falling further behind. And I think that together is a disaster for Biden. That dynamic of, I can't work hard enough to get ahead of this tide that never ceases coming in of inflation. The Biden administration's idea that, we have the numbers showing how hard you're paddling isn't actually reassuring.
Phil.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue is that we've had several years of very high inflation followed by several years of elevated inflation. And the problem is that people have very recent memories of things costing less. Now, I don't, I do the grocery shopping in our household. I don't remember what things might have cost in 2009, 2011, but I know that there are certain things that might be, that I might have paid $19.95 for that are $23.99 now, or things that used to be $4.99 that are now $5.99 or $6.29. And those things add up and people just remember them. So the Biden administration keeps trying to spin things, and there are certain things that you could spin. People aren't necessarily looking at CBO reports as Dominic and I like to do and sort of going over deficit numbers. So if you just sort of say the deficit was bad under Trump and we cut the deficit without getting into, well, this is relative to sort of COVID era and et cetera, you know, people could glaze over. They're not going to think about, but people know what they paid for a product, you know, as recently as a few years ago, and how it's significantly more expensive. And when Biden was inaugurated, the value of a dollar, you'd now need $1.19 to be able to purchase the same basket of goods that would cost you a dollar when he was sworn in. And people noticed that.
So MBDX, a question to you. Let's go to a separate political issue for the exit question. There's been some back and forth about the potential debate in the fall, debates between Trump and Biden. Do you think there will be a debate or debates between Trump and Biden in the fall? Yes or no?
Between the men, no. Maybe they'll each send like a ChatGPT version of themselves.
and why not?
Because Biden's team will be afraid to do 2 hours with Trump, but officially they'll say they'll come up with some kind of, we're trying to save democracy here, so we're not going to give Trump a platform. I don't know, something like that.
Dominic, there'll be a debate, yes or no?
I find this to be a very difficult question. On the one hand, Donald Trump loves being on TV, and Joe Biden needs to be on TV to prove wrong the impression that many voters have that he's too old or unable to do that. And so I think there's a temptation for both sides to want to do it. I think Trump has it much more because he wants to illustrate Biden's feebleness and his relative vigor. And so what I think will happen, what I'll say right now, is that they'll do one, and there will have been more scheduled when they do the one, but then
the one will be so terrible.
It's going to be so bad that everyone will decide this is not worth it, and they won't do another one.
Phil.
Yeah, Dominic stole my thunder there. I'd say we'll get a debate, not debates, plural.
So I'm a little bit in the MBD territory. It's going to be so risky and so hard. And I think that the rationale is the one Dominic outlines. If Biden does the debate, it's going to be because he needs to put aside, you know, the concerns about his age by showing he can show up and be okay for 90 minutes. But that 9 o'clock at night, you know, with no teleprompter, having to think on his feet the whole time, it's going to be, I don't know, it seems like such a heavy lift. So I tilt no, but if it's yes, it's going to be for the reasons that Dominic outlined, and it's going to be the scenario that Dominic outlines. It'll just be one of these suckers. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, the University of Austin. The University of Austin, or UATX, the newest university in America, is accepting applications now for fall 2024. UATX's founding 100 students will each receive a full tuition scholarship to attend class at the university's downtown campus in the heart of Austin, Texas. UATX is building a new institution grounded in the wisdom of the past and launched towards the knowledge and insight of the future. Students will study the liberal arts and sciences with distinguished faculty and work with Austin mentors who have started companies, pioneered discoveries, and built from the ground up. Visit uaustin.org. That's uaustin.org to learn more and apply to join the University of Austin's founding freshman class. So, Phil, we lost O.J. Simpson this week. Not much of a loss. This guy was a total dirtbag. He literally got away with murder. The only reason, I guess, he didn't, as a practical matter, totally get away with it is he was nailed on this robbery charge involving sports memorabilia, so ended up imprisoned on that one. But he should have been imprisoned the first time around. In a ludicrous and highly racially charged case, he is acquitted and kind of lives the life of Ryan for a while there. You know, he was a celebrity, right? He was a celebrity before he killed Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman, but then, you know, was even more of a celebrity afterwards, or a different kind of celebrity, notorious, where he'd been famous, but, you know, people would stop and gawk at him and on the streets and talk to him. And there were various projects around him, TV projects and whatnot. What do you make of OJ's legacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is just hard just looking back on it. I remember I was late in high school when the OJ stuff was happening. I remember crowding around one television when the verdict came down. And it seemed to me that it's just hard looking back on it to think of another event that just sort of dominated the culture and the media for such a sustained period of time. I mean, obviously COVID and 9/11, but those are sort of different beasts. As terms of a cultural event, I mean, it was basically from the time the murder happened until through the verdict, you had, what was it, maybe a year and a half where that was just the only thing that was in the media practically was the OJ stuff. And it's just, I feel like a lot of the racial politics of today can be traced back to a lot of the OJ stuff. It of course had followed by a few years, the LA riots. And so that's why it was tried in downtown LA rather than Santa Monica, closer to where the murder actually happened and where, you know, the prospect of him being found guilty by an all-white jury freaked out LA, and so then they moved it downtown. The whole idea, I mean, if you saw the one tweet yesterday about how, you know, OJ was a scumbag, he did it, but he needed to get off anyway.
Yeah.
That was Mark Lamont Hill was saying that, like, it was important for race that he get off anyway.
Racial justice and better race relations, that this guy be allowed to kill two white people because he's black. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I kind of feel like a lot of the, and somebody was, I just feel like a lot of the, sort of the way the culture digests a lot of the racial issues of today can be traced back to everything that was going on during the OJ case.
Yeah. So MBD, I remember actually that day of the chase in the white Ford Bronco is before the time when everyone was connected. And I believe it was a Friday night, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And I was at a Yankee game. The Yankees played the Brewers at the old Yankee Stadium. We were in the upper deck, you know, imbibed a lot of brewskis and stumbled downtown into a bar in Manhattan and to watch the Knicks game. The Knicks were in the playoffs against someone or other.
The Rockets. It was the finals.
Okay, yeah. And they interrupted this bar had a makeshift movie screen type setup for everyone to see this game, and they preempted it to do the OJ chase, and people were Knicks fans were like, kill him, just kill him now. But it's really, as Jim noted in his jolt today, you know, OJ was an incredibly charismatic guy. You know, and talk about someone who had everything, right? He had fame, riches, women, you know, everything. And it just goes to the evil in the human heart that this was a deeply disturbed and violent sociopath, basically. And it was a time also, as Jim points out, when there was more allowance for sort of covering up who and what celebrities really were. And then we learned about OJ in the most shocking fashion possible.
I mean, I don't know. I'm supposed to be the contrarian, right? I mean, I think the real killers are breathing a sigh of relief today. Now that the man who rushed for 11,236 yards in his career, 4 NFL rushing titles, 76 touchdowns, 5 Pro Bowls, is not chasing them anymore. I mean, I mean, to the end of his life, I'm sure that O.J. Simpson was dedicated to nothing other than what he said he was. After the trial, finding the real killers. Yeah, O.J. Simpson killed those two people, Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson, and did so in the most heinous, intimate, and disgusting way possible. You know, knife violence is incredibly depraved.
Yeah, it's like a crime of passion, a premeditated crime of passion.
It's a premeditated crime of passion, but it's also like, it is difficult for people who are defending themselves from death, from imminent bodily harm or death, to plunge a knife into the human flesh of their attacker, because it's such a grotesque act, and it's so violent, and it violates people in such a profound way.
And they were defending themselves, Nicole and Ron, you know, with their hands. They had wounds on their hands. They stabbed him maybe 25 times or something.
And you know, he was able, through his celebrity and his money, and through the to buy the kind of lawyering that turned his criminal trial into a total freak show. And circus, and that kind of overwhelmed the very well prepared LA attorneys who went after him, Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden, who I think unjustly earned this reputation of losing the worst a case they should have won, that they were never going to win
unjustly because the. That just so politically stacked against them.
Yeah. You know, of course the most notable thing about the OJ trial was when the reaction, when the verdict was read out. I mean, I think millions of Americans that were alive that day, I certainly remember it. I was in eighth grade and I was in a classroom, and the teacher was playing it live on the radio. It's like, here's the end of the trial of the century. We're going to get a verdict. Finally, you know, this whole national thing that we've been watching for months is coming to an end. And the teacher I had was African American, and I was just not prepared for her reaction when the not guilty verdict came in.
She was visibly pleased.
I mean, she like jumped for joy. And started celebrating along with every black student in the class, and every white and Asian kid was like, not sure what to do. Some joining in uncomfortably, and some was like, and I came home and my mother said the same reaction she saw at work. And you saw you see in the documentaries of the time, the same reaction in the streets. And
yeah,
it just showed this unbelievable gulf between white and black America that I think, you know, people had thought maybe, you know, after the LA riots, the election of Bill Clinton, maybe there'd been some healing or rapprochement or something. But the gulf was still there. And the sentiment that Mark Lamont Hill expressed of, he's guilty, but it's good he got off, was the primary motivating factor, and it strikes a lot of people as just perverse.
Yeah. So Dominic, you don't remember a time, I assume, when O.J. Simpson was not a double murderer, but one of the lessons here is just how terrible it is when people are made into categories and symbols. So at the end of the day, this wasn't about black versus white. You know, it wasn't about a celebrity and non-famous people or whatever else. It was about one heinous individual snuffing out the lives brutally of two other individuals. And it always should have been judged on that basis. And that's the real meaning.
Yeah, Rich, I was negative 4 years old when the trial happened, so I don't have any memories of this. I think it is underrated. You know, you talk about categories. One of the other categories that O.J. Simpson fit in was Buffalo Bill, and just the cursedness of this poor franchise in Buffalo. The only team to win four conference championships in a row, which is a polite way of saying the only team to ever lose four Super Bowls in a row. Yeah, and then arguably their best player of all time turns out to be a murderer. And it's really, really stunning, the bad luck of that franchise. But I think you're right. It shows, you know, what celebrity can do. And I think that's probably why it was so fascinating to people. Because like you said, this guy had everything. He had, you know, every material thing you could want. And clearly that didn't suffice. And so that concept, I think, is always interesting to people, and fascinating and morbidly so in this case. And I think that's probably why the staying power is there for this story.
Can I restate something a little provocatively? You know, I said the impulse that celebrated his exoneration or his not guilty verdict was perverse, but I think I want to restate it in that I think when the not guilty verdict came down, I think a lot of people who celebrated it from this really strange sense that his not guilty verdict was a step towards like equality, that the American justice system is just inveterately corrupted, right? So it's just by money.
Black people can get away with stuff too. Finally.
Yes. A rich black celebrity can just as much get away with something as a rich white celebrity. And mm-hmm. that, I think that is sort of like why it was almost celebrated as like a sign of progress. Cause it's mm-hmm. like, right. Normally a black man assaulting a white woman gets more than justice. Right.
You look at her in the South, or you whistle at her.
Yeah. They get more than justice. They get lynched.
Yeah.
And this time it showed that like a black man who had real money, and there was a kind of celebration of black entrepreneurialism in the 90s. There was a kind of theme of that. And kind of how important black culture was to American culture. It showed like, in a way, we've come this far. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, it's a kind of, it is perverse, but there was a logic to it.
So let me hit you, speaking of progress, MBD, with the exit question, which is a big one. It requires some thought. So maybe unfair, but are race relations better now than they were in 1994?
I think it washes out. I think there's, you know, there is much more, I think there's much more interracial comity on the ground level. I think there's more kids grow up in racially diverse schools than previously.
And in racially diverse families.
In racially diverse families, and I was getting to that. And then, but on the other hand, I do think there is a kind of political war
mm-hmm.
for defining how Asian, recent Asian and Latino immigrants will understand themselves in America going forward. Will they understand themselves as an extension of non-white, mm-hmm. non-whites, and in a sense heirs to the oppression and co-victims of white supremacy? Or will they understand themselves as like part of the American mainstream from which blacks feel like they have been excluded? And I think that the kind of subterranean politics under that are really intense and really fraught right now. Whereas I think in 1994, it still felt like America was a land of three races, really, really whites, blacks, and Native Americans, and the story was just making sure African Americans reached parity.
Yeah. Phil?
I think it's probably gotten worse since the 90s. I just feel like the left has sort of succeeded in turning everything into a race issue. And when you combine that with social media and the influence of social media, which tends to amplify the most provocative voices, I think that it just has created more tension than existed at the time when we were more moving towards the world of people not caring as much about race. I feel like now the leftist ideal is race is everything. And if you look, I'm just looking at the polling on Gallup of just the, you know, do you think race relations between white and black people are very good, somewhat bad, or very bad? The Gallup polling goes back to 2001, so not quite to the 90s. But basically, in 2001, 70% of whites and 62% of black adults said that things were generally at least somewhat good. And now that's down to 43% among whites and 33% among blacks. So there's just been sort of a dramatic downturn in people's perception of how race relations are. And I feel like this is the sort of issue where there's a thin line between perception and reality. If you think things are really bad, it's, you know, it's going to make things worse. So I'd say that things have gotten worse.
Dominic.
It's a really hard question. I guess, you know, I think the family effect that you talked about earlier is really, really important. And I think that plays a role in making things better. Just because, for example, you know, basically nobody, it's very hard to find anyone who thinks that interracial marriage is wrong in the United States anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago, you could find people who said that.
That sentiment just collapsed.
Yeah, basically everyone thinks that's fine. That's a positive development. And part of the reason why that's a positive development is that there's lots more people in mixed raced families, and so you're guaranteed, you're almost guaranteed to personally know someone in that situation, right? And personal knowledge of people of different races, you know, personal acquaintances with them makes it really hard to makes it really hard to hate them, right? And so
One of the frustrating parts of one of the frustrating countervailing pieces of evidence is great that we have more interracial couples, more interracial folks, but there's this tendency if you just have a drop, you know, of African American blood, you are African American, you're black with a capital B, and I think that'll be one of going to the phenomenon that Phil was highlighting, one of the artifacts of that when we look back to how racialized this era is in one sense is the capital B, you know, in every newspaper referring to black people.
Yeah. And you know, our racial classification system in the United States is completely bonkers. It makes no sense either, you know, biologically or anything else. And so I think there's growing attention to that. You know, there's the book by David Bernstein about this, a couple of years ago that did a really good job going into a lot of the history of this. You saw, you know, Neil Gorsuch write about this, in the Supreme Court opinion, about how our, you know, the way we classify people by race is completely nonsensical. I think the impression of that will grow with people because, like I said, they're gonna meet people and they're not gonna obviously fit into one of these categories. And eventually there will be, you know, more realization that the reason for that is that the categories themselves don't make any sense.
Yeah. So Coleman Hughes has a passage about this at the beginning of his book on colorblindness. The two great books about this come out recently is Coleman's one and Andre Archie, who writes for us a lot, also wrote a defense of colorblindness, but he talks about, I think it's South Africa where the test they had like in the '60s or whatever, whether you're colored was whether a pencil could go through your hair without any difficulty, you know, and we don't do that, but that's, we affect do the same thing, with kind of the one drop attitude. I'm going to say better, but I think clearly there's this divide where I think individually, race relations are better, but the story we're telling ourselves, and kind of the racialized policies and DEI and all that is, tends towards making it worse. And it depends on just which you see more important or kind of winning out at the moment. I would say at the granular individual level, things are better. And I think that's more important. But as Phil says, you know, this racialized attitude and discourse, to use a fashionable word, could over time really make the individual relations worse. And that would be a terrible tragedy. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at naturalview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up and log in, to see about 90% fewer ads your way. If you want to, if it floats your boat, to comment on articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive events and calls with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures. It's a great deal all around. And most importantly, it's a really crucial way to support a valuable journalism. We don't need people to pay a lot for our content, but we do need them to pay a little. So if you're not already a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus today, tomorrow, or the day after. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been watching the series Sugar.
Yeah, there's a new Apple TV series starring Colin Farrell, who I really think is actually a great actor. And it's a kind of Philip Marlowe style LA noir where Colin Farrell plays John Sugar, a private investigator and really a missing person finder. And he's looking for the daughter of a rich LA former filmmaker. And it has lots of the kind of classic, you know, the Big Sleep style references in it so far. It's truly stylish. I'm kind of watching it because every review of it says that it has a twist that is horrible and ruins the series, but so far it's super stylish, and the thing that really stands out about it is the detective character is portrayed as unambiguously virtuous and good, like kind to women, kind to the homeless, kind even to the targets of his investigation, kind of trying to give them nonviolent ways out of the situation they found themselves in. And it's just such a contrast from the anti-hero trend in prestige television.
So Dominic, you've been reading a big book called India After Gandhi.
Yeah, India After Gandhi. It's by the historian Ramachandra Guha, and it's a great book. I'm about 300 pages through the 800 pages of it. I don't usually like to read really long books like that. Anything over like 400, 450, I usually get a little wary. But this one has been fantastic, and you know, I genuinely look forward to being able to say I have completed it.
Phil, you've been watching or saw, went to a screening of Born Yesterday, an old movie?
Yeah, I went to a screening of this movie. It was came out in 1950. It was a fun old movie. One of the takes place in D.C. And one of the basically the plot line is involves a mob boss who's trying to get his fiance to be more educated. So he hires this reporter to kind of teach her more. And so a lot of involves them going to different sites in D.C. And what struck me was just the sort of reverence in which like our founding and like they visit the Jefferson Memorial and she's in awe, and they visit the founding documents and she's looking at the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, sort of enamored by them. And then the kicker is she reads a part of the Bill of Rights and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be
freedom of press or something that leftist Hollywood is satisfied with. And she just reads out the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And I'm just sitting there shocked. And it was kind of bittersweet. The movie's good. You know, it's a great old movie, classic movie. But just, it was kind of bittersweet just seeing a Hollywood and a popular culture that kind of celebrated our founding. It was a bit sad to see, like, given the way that, you know, it would just never happen today in the movies, where you wouldn't see something that wouldn't be hostile toward our founders and our founding documents.
So I am reviewing a book for NR called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic, about John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Movie reviews are always very alluring because you don't, in theory, need to really do any research or any work. You just read the book and then write about it. But it always ends up being harder than it seems. But I've been sucked in by this because I love The Blues Brothers. I think it's one of the greatest American films ever made. And one of the wonderful things about this book, first 100 pages, a little too much on the origin stories of Belushi and Aykroyd, not that interested in their upbringing. But about page 100, you really get into the beginning of SNL, and it's been fun to read about a skit in a certain episode and then go watch the clip of it. There's, at the beginning, they had these bees were a theme. They dressed up the cast in bee suits, and John Belushi hated this, and he was walking in New York with his girlfriend at one point, and someone said, "Hey, there's the bee. There's the bee guy." And he was just so angry. But anyway, there's this hilarious, literally laugh out loud skit with Rob Reiner, who was a big time actor then on Archie Bunker. Not very into this chaotic improv style comedy. And they had him do this skit in a restaurant where he's having a very deep conversation with a woman with whom he's having an affair. And then these bees come in. They're the staff, and the bees are playing a guitar, romantic guitar music. And then he ends up getting in an argument with John Belushi, who's dressed up as a bee. And it's laugh out loud funny, just laugh out loud funny. So anyway, I'm enjoying this book. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
This was inevitable. I'm picking Armand White's review of Civil War, a movie which comes out today. It is by Dan Garland, and it's kind of, or Alex Garland, I'm sorry. And it's an obvious fantasy of, you know, basically assassinating a Trump-like figure. And Armand White goes at it with exactly the fire that you would expect from him on something like this.
Dominic, what's your pick?
My pick is your piece, Rich, about Biden's student loans, called No One Cares About Joe Biden's Lawlessness. I think it's an argument that conservatives are accustomed to making, is that this policy goal that I have is desirable. I would like to see it, but it's unconstitutional. And so, or the way in which it is being pursued is unconstitutional, and we should do it a different way, because I still think it's a good idea in the end. I think for conservatives and for anybody who makes an argument like that, I think it's a marker of intellectual honesty. And Richard Peace is pointing out that there's really not a lot of that kind of argument on the left about Biden's student loan plan, which is flatly unconstitutional. Even if you think it's a good idea, which I don't, to forgive student loan debt, there's a constitutional way to do it, which is to pass a law through Congress. And it's very hard to find anybody who will make that argument on the left. And I think your piece does a good job of just pointing out this gaping hole in the discourse.
Thanks, Dominic. Phil?
I'm going to pick a piece by Abigail Anthony titled "Princeton Democratic Socialists Raise Grave Concern Over Discriminatory Gorilla Image." And basically, it's just sort of more campus hilarity. There is this professor who actually happens to be a Black Haitian
who for a French class put out a slideshow which contained various animals and gorillas. And then there was another slideshow that contained the Obamas. And the TA in the class, who's a socialist and part of the Democratic Socialists of Princeton, was all up in arms about how the whole experience caused him anxiety. And they lobbied Princeton to remove this. And it's just, there's just so many hilarious details of it that this guy's focus is queer zoo poetics, which is how queer literary culture dialogues with our understanding of animals. It's just sort of, if you need some sort of...
That person has a plum barista job ahead of him or her.
Yeah.
So my pick is the aforementioned Morning Jolt by Jim Garrity. If you can read one thing and just want to be reminded about a really important, everything important about the OJ phenomenon, read Jim's Jolt. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Dominic. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Patriot Voices and the University of Austin. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We are the editors. One orange whip, two orange whips, three orange whips.